American coal.
Nuclear energy. Natural gas. Hydro.
Solar power.
Wind turbines.
We're becoming a monumental exporter of natural gas.
This boom in the United States is not a bubble that's going away.
The oil's still there. I'd rather pump it from another country and save ours, and then when the rest of the world runs out, hey, guess what? We can still turn on our lights.
We've run into a problem where we have constraints, where there are limits now.
The new phase we're going into, related to the exhaustion of these resources, there's no replacement. This is a one-shot affair, and we're unprepared for it.
Really, that we do not have very much more time to get a handle on this problem.
It's better to get to a renewable future, a sustainable future, sooner rather than later. Get there before we do the environmental damage, not after.
For November 15th, 2017, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh.
Welcome to the Energy Transition Show. I'm your host, Chris Nelder. There's a lot of talk and excitement in energy circles these days about the blockchain and how it might change the ways that we generate, consume, and trade energy, in addition to its better-known application as the basis for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. But is the blockchain just another shiny object generating a lot of techno hype and attracting people who are just looking for the next big score in tech? Or does it have real potential to enable truly transformational change? What's the difference between just using the tokens and distributed ledgers of blockchain technology and using it to create cryptocurrencies? And how would it even work in an energy context? That is, apart from just being an alternative currency in which we might do transactions. Frankly, the answers to these questions are yet to be determined because there aren't that many actual commercial implementations of blockchain technology in energy markets yet. However, neither is it a mere twinkle in the eye of a few technologists as it was a few years ago. Serious people at serious companies, including utilities, are now exploring ways that they might use the blockchain, not just to, for example, enable transactions that might have been impractical in the past because even a small transaction or service fee, like that charged by a bank or a utility, might have been prohibitively expensive, like charging a 2-cent fee on a 5-cent transaction, but also to enable transactions and trade in a secure way where, until now, it would have been too difficult or expensive to make them secure. Or to enable transactions that need to happen so quickly that only computers talking to each other could manage them, or even having to run transactions through a computerized processing center might be too slow. You may have heard about some of these new applications, like the distributed computing platform Ethereum, the peer-to-peer energy transaction system known as the Brooklyn Microgrid, and the Australian startup called Power Ledger, which seeks to create a peer-to-peer renewable energy network, and which recently completed its ICO, the cryptocurrency equivalent of an IPO, raising more than $24 million from some 15,000 supporters. It's a brave new world, to be sure, but how is all this going to even work in the real world? To help us understand this new, mostly abstract and rarefied world, our guest today is Molly Webb, the founder of Energy Unlocked, an organization that seeks to accelerate the pace of energy transition by enabling innovators to create new decentralized markets in energy, such as demand response, creating new opportunities to bring low-cost, low-carbon, and resilient energy to all. She's worked for over a decade on market acceleration and advocacy for global innovation in tech, climate change, smart cities, and energy, including stints at the Climate Group and the UK think tank Demos, and previously she worked in software and IT in New York, Tokyo, and London. She has an MSc in environmental policy at the London School of Economics, and it's a great pleasure to have her on the show. Then, in the news segment, we'll revisit why solar is crushing coal in India, what's great and what's lacking in the latest levelized cost of energy data from Lazard, new low solar prices in several developing countries, and a new energy podcast you might want to check out. But first, our conversation with Molly Webb. So let's bring her to the conversation now. Welcome, Molly, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thank you very much.
So the blockchain is still a pretty abstract thing, I think, for most of us. So we should probably start by explaining very briefly how it works. How would you describe the blockchain?
So blockchain is the underlying technology
of the most famous application, Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency. And the best description I've heard of blockchain is by Joey Ito, who said blockchain essentially makes information into a thing. And that is the kind of highest level and best description I've heard. So we can turn information that when the internet has made information free, blockchain allows us to make it scarce again and something we can trade. And that isn't just for cryptocurrencies, that can be for assets of other types. So the underlying technology of that is a distributed ledger. We've had ledgers for a long time. We need someone to account for the fact that I might have sold you a book, and I'm not going to be able to sell that same book to someone else. And that fundamentally allows us to trade things between us. And that by distributing that ledger, you no longer need a central intermediary to verify that I indeed did sell you that book. That's distributed across different what we call nodes in the network, and each node can verify that that's true. And therefore, we no longer need to have the kind of central bank or central, you know, the Bank of England or any other entity doing that verification for us. That's probably the simplest level. We can get into how that's secured, what the sort of computing is that secures that, but I'm not sure if that maybe will come into a next question.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about security at some point, but I just wanted to kind of establish. So when you say distributed, you really mean, I think, that there are copies of it everywhere. Like everyone has a copy of every transaction.
So the ledger is held on these different nodes. And that way, every time somebody in the node wants to add a block to the chain, the other nodes will verify indeed that that can happen. So if somebody tries to add a block that isn't complying with the rules of that network, that system that have been defined in the software, then they won't be able to do that because the others will recognize that that shouldn't happen. So each node has a copy, essentially.
Okay. And a block is a transaction?
Or a group of transactions.
Okay. All right.
So it's defined by how that system is defined when it's set up.
Okay. So, you know, I think most people hear blockchain and they think Bitcoin because that's probably the one that most of us have heard of, or maybe cryptocurrency because there's actually more than one type of currency like Bitcoin out there.
Yeah.
But as it might apply to energy transition, we're not actually talking about alternate currencies in some cases necessarily, right? So what are some of the interesting applications of the blockchain to energy?
So first, before we talk specifically about energy, I think of the Bitcoin as a form of, you could call it a token.
Okay.
So blockchain with Bitcoin, the blockchain is essentially secured with the mining or the computation that takes place. And that computation is rewarded with the Bitcoin. So in that application, it's a very direct relationship between essentially as the value of that coin goes up, there's more incentive for everyone to keep the network secure because they earn more Bitcoin. So the cryptocurrency is one form of this token reward system. And the token is really what's interesting. We now have the ability to create what are called utility tokens, not utilities in the sense of energy companies or, you know, our suppliers of electricity. But utility as in they have some sort of useful function outside of just being a currency.
Yeah.
So those are the main two types of token. And then you can also have a kind of security, almost a token that's like a share in a company.
Okay.
And so cryptocurrencies aren't the most exciting application of blockchain at the moment. It's the ability to create an incentive structure that aligns differently the interests of a group, multiple parties, to deliver a certain outcome. And that's what you use a utility token for. And that would be applied to any sector. So for energy, you can imagine that, yes, you could have a cryptocurrency that, say, represented kilowatt hours, and you'd be trading kilowatt hours with a coin instead of with dollars. I don't think that's the most exciting. So the most interesting applications in energy would be where we could combine blockchain technology, this ledger technology, with the incentive system of a token like a Bitcoin, but it isn't a currency per se. It has some function in the real world. So you can imagine using that to make settlement more efficient and secure that settlement in different ways than we currently need to. You could imagine applying that to peer-to-peer electricity trading, for instance. So those are a couple of the applications, but anywhere that there is inefficiency in the transactions because multiple parties are involved and that needs to be secured, blockchain can be used. So it's a pretty open space in the energy sector or multiple sectors that touch on energy, whether that's transport or power or heating or any other area.
Right. Okay. So I think I'm following what you're saying, and it is interesting to think about this token as being sort of a unit of information. I never really thought about it that way before. Mm-hmm. So let me try to put this into concrete terms because I think that's helpful.
Yeah.
So let's take something that's not necessarily a financial transaction where this token is playing a different role. So let's say demand response, okay? Let's say that I'm going to turn off my water heater when grid conditions are tight mm-hmm. as a form of demand response. And so it is a transaction that probably I would get paid for at some level. But before we know about that, we have to verify that I've turned off my water heater. So it's really that fact, that little bit of information that I've turned off the water heater in response to a demand response call being put out by the utility. So mm-hmm. would that be an application of the blockchain to just say, I'm responding, I have turned off my water heater?
Yeah, and I mean, I think you can obviously do that now. We have demand response applications today that don't need blockchain.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get into that in a minute.
But
I'm just trying to come up with a concrete example that's not necessarily a financial transaction in and of itself.
Yeah, so I think if you want to be able to say that indeed this air conditioner or this cooling system has the ability to turn off right now, you could be storing that information on a blockchain. And you could, if you have the communication system, the blockchain could send that information so that that unit can be turned off based on a smart contract of some kind that says every time that this particular signal comes from the electricity grid, we will do this to the asset. So it's essentially a way of automating a control function in that way.
Oh, okay. That's a helpful way to think about it. So let's talk about what's particularly special about the blockchain in doing these things better than the existing methods.
So I think we imagine that everyone is going to be connected to connectivity, to the internet in some way. And that includes devices, machines. So we expect 50 billion or more devices to be connected in the near future. So we're going to be living in a world in which there is a huge amount of information, data coming out of a huge number of devices, and then all of us who want to interact efficiently with those devices. So in that world, the idea that you would be able to centralize all of those transactions and somehow verify them and secure them seems a little bit far-fetched. But a world in which that's decentralized and a lot of that verification, a lot of the transactions can happen outside of having to have these centralized systems is really exciting because it seems like that will be the most scalable way to deliver the kind of vision we have for a lot of interactions and transactions around energy happening all over the place, not just from the centralized generation through transmission distribution out to the edge. We imagine a world in which electric vehicles, the assets in commercial and industrial sites or in buildings or in homes are all sort of able to shape their load in response to intermittent renewables. And I think that requires the kind of evolution that blockchain allows. So that's what's really exciting.
Okay, so if I'm following your logic here, there's an advantage in that there doesn't have to be a bottleneck in the centralized clearinghouse for all these transactions, that these transactions themselves can be distributed and happening sort of autonomously from device to device without having to be centrally collected and processed. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's a huge use case for blockchain. So just being able to say that we will allow some things where it makes sense to happen in this distributed way opens up some of the scaling, you know, the challenges we think we have with scaling large data systems. I also think we haven't begun to explore the new business models that are able to be developed. So in my view, some of the biggest hurdle to energy transitions is just the challenge of innovation in energy.
Yeah.
So because we are so good at delivering electricity and other forms of energy, because it's so critical to our economies, we allow very little room for error and very little room for things to be volatile in price or for things to go wrong. We would really want that to be the most secure, robust system possible. So it's very difficult to innovate as a result. And we have sort of organized all of our systems around that security, and the innovation, unfortunately, becomes much harder. So what I think is exciting about blockchain is it lets you think a little bit out of the box about some of the business models that would be available if we could have that level of security and robustness while also allowing interactions that maybe aren't regulated today. You know, I think that's kind of what some call the platform plays, or, you know, that's what gets really exciting.
Yeah.
The most obvious use case being peer-to-peer trading of electricity, which isn't actually legal in most countries. But the idea that you'd be able to bring the sharing economy to energy, we start with that idea of peer-to-peer trading of electricity, but that is really just the beginning. And yeah, we'll come back to it, I'm sure, when we talk through blockchain, but we're really early days in blockchain. But it is that promise of bringing new innovation, new business model types to an industry that hasn't been disrupted in decades that gets most of us excited, I think.
Well, that's interesting, you know, because I guess I've been particularly skeptical about this. And well, for one thing, it's been hyped to death. And so that automatically makes me skeptical. But also, you know, I guess I've been just sort of waiting for the proof. You know, it's like, all right, well, why is this better? I hear what you're saying is saying, well, it's new. We're going to find out why it's better. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
Now, this is an opportunity for innovation. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You know, we're seeing, I think it's called Energy eMotorworks Share and Charge. They're doing a pilot in California, which lets you share your electric vehicle charge amongst neighbors and others. These are small trials at the moment, but the implication is we wouldn't have to slow down the uptake or acceleration of these new services that we want to see if we had the ability to really allow them to interact in a secure and safe way. So we might think peer-to-peer electricity trading today, but there may be other business processes that benefit from this and other consumer applications that we just haven't even begun to explore. I don't think that's happening this year or next year, but certainly some of these trials that we're starting to see will build confidence, and then we'll see, you know, further iterations of those. And probably in 5 years, we'll be seeing, even if you don't know you're using a token system or a blockchain system, there'll be something behind the scenes that's enabling that.
Right. Okay. So a recent study, which we'll link to in the show notes, by the German Energy Agency and the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin, surveyed some 70 German energy executives and found that the majority of them believe that blockchain technology is definitely coming to the energy sector, and they're actively exploring how to use it. About half the use cases that they identified concern routine tasks like billing and sales and marketing and automation, metering, data transfer, mobility, communication, grid management, all this kind of stuff, while the other half pertained to just trading and decentralized energy generation. And this study seems to indicate that there's no real significant edge for blockchain technology where there are already efficient digital solutions, but that new markets, like managing transactions and billing for electric vehicle charging, as you just mentioned, actually could be built on the blockchain. And that sounds about right to me. But on the other hand, I don't see any reason why they couldn't also be built on conventional solutions and managed by credit card companies like every other consumer transaction. So what's the big deal? Like, do these German energy executives really see an important cost-cutting advantage on the blockchain, or are they all just suffering from an acute attack of FOMO, you know, fear of missing out?
I think that probably the response of energy companies to blockchain is the same as other innovations. Let's slow down, let's watch it very carefully, and let's make sure it doesn't disrupt our business model. On the other hand, they will be seeing ways to apply this for all those reasons you talked about: more efficiency, cost cutting, more efficient transactions. If we've been around energy transitions long enough, we've seen, for instance, smart meter rollouts, and the justification of those was that this would save consumers X percent on their bills. But really, the utilities had a business case for that, which was not always to do with the amazing potential of these technologies to be utilized by consumers, but also to do with the fact that this would make their lives a lot easier. So I think blockchain right now is certainly going to be part of the energy transition, because it's going to be part of your credit card company's transition as well. So we may not see utilities adopt this at scale right away. They may be waiting, but the financial transactions that they might use on credit cards will be also being disrupted at the same time. So this is really coming. It's not like any of them can avoid it. So I think there's many of these utilities are smart to be thinking about this. They're looking at it, the German Energy Agency and Germany in general, because they are sort of at the forefront of what the challenges are of a fast renewable transition. They're right. Looking around at what are the solutions to that, and blockchain could play a role in that. I think we're hoping for technologies and business models that start to allow us to actually deliver the promise of renewables, for instance. So Germany has experienced growth in renewables, but their emissions levels remain low. There was a New York Times article about this last week. You know, emissions remain at the same level. So emissions are around 2009 levels in spite of the increase in renewables. Countries like Germany are thinking, how do we benefit from the investments we've made in the grid and new generation infrastructure, but don't have to build the parallel backup fossil fuel system to maintain that? And blockchain is part of that answer, right? So I think we're seeing these utilities want to look at this, and they will be cautious, and they will incorporate it in countries like Germany or the US or other parts of Europe or Australia, where there's already a fairly advanced grid. They'll incorporate it into what they're already doing, and there'll be a small role for these new business models. We hope that role grows quickly. And then you're right, the places where there's a lot more scope for innovation, where we don't have the strong regulatory regimes, or we don't have the existing infrastructure investments that large companies are really designed to protect, then we're going to see a lot of innovation in off-grid or in new electric vehicles in places where that infrastructure isn't in place. So I think utilities rightly should be looking at this. I don't think it's just fear of missing out. I think they're actually terrified that there will be something that disrupts them, and that's more their motivation.
So it's more of a defensive move on their part to make sure that they're aware of what's coming at them and that they know how to engage with it.
Well, I think also what I started out in terms of saying, in terms of the sheer number of devices that they expect to be connected to networks, I mean, that is not an easy thing to manage. So they don't necessarily think they're being defensive, and they do the slow, methodical approach for the right reasons, in their view. But for new market entrants and others that Energy Unlocked engages with extensively, they are much more impatient for the transition. And so they would probably be skeptical of how utilities are viewing this.
Yeah. And just, you know, for the record, that New York Times article that you mentioned, I hated that article.
Oh, you did?
I hated that article.
That's so interesting.
Oh, my God. In fact, I hated it so much.
I just picked out that one fact.
Oh, I hated it so much. I went off on a whole Twitter rant about it. Like the, you know.
Oh, sorry. I missed that. I'm going to go check it out.
I'll stick it in the show notes.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, there's just been a lot of hoary old myths about Germany's energy transition that just keep getting repeated year after year, no matter how many times they're debunked.
Is that one of them?
Well, the fact that Germany's emissions haven't dropped that much in recent years is not in dispute, right? The problem is that people like that author want to go relitigate the intent of Germany's energy transition to be about emissions reduction, which it was never designed to do. It was from the very beginning an attempt to phase out nuclear very deliberately.
Absolutely.
And they had their reasons for doing that. And, you know, the rest of the world might, you know, from a modern perspective, start saying, well, we sure wish those guys had been phasing out coal instead of nuclear starting in the 1970s. But in the 1970s, they had reasons for wanting to phase out nuclear. Mm-hmm. That was what the Energiewende was about. It was very successful. It was not a failure, as that author in the New York Times has tried to claim. And it was just designed to achieve a different outcome than the one that he wants it to achieve. So that's just too bad, you know?
Yeah. But, well, you bring up, this is a really important point. I think what I maybe am not getting to directly, but I should, is that blockchain is like any other enabling technology. And we've had Internet of Things and smart grid and smart cities and a whole range of sort of buckets of new technological capabilities emerge over the last 10 years or longer. And the question is, to what outcome are we going to put these capabilities? And it's very important for all of us who work in the energy transition space to understand these new technologies, I believe, because we want to be directing them toward the outcomes we want to see. And I do think you're right that we would love decarbonization to be the sole aim of the Energiewende, but as you say, there's a history there. And we will have to be on the lookout for that. When we look to apply blockchain and the sort of surrounding economic interactions that you can create with these token systems, we have to be thinking very carefully about what this sort of game theory is and what we're trying to incentivize, and look for ways that that might be not happening and guide it along the way. It's sort of governance of new technology in the most basic sense.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I recently came across a story about a new blockchain-based energy sharing token in the Netherlands named the Juliet, after the Joule unit of measure for energy. So very cute.
Yes, very.
Apparently, the idea with this is that it will enable peer-to-peer transactions between members of a community without a bank acting as the intermediary. So that, for example, one neighbor could buy solar energy from another neighbor who has solar on his house without any particular restrictions between them. But are the market barriers like that really so onerous that it's worth building a whole new transactive system for such applications? Is it really so difficult to let a utility buy the excess power from one of its customers and then sell it back to another? Or is the blockchain really a solution in search of a problem?
We have seen other peer-to-peer solutions. So the tokenization of that is just starting. And I think we'll see a lot more of these. It is possible to do peer-to-peer electricity trading, and the bank isn't really the problem. It's the retail electricity supplier that has to be in the equation in a regulated market.
That's right.
You can't sell to your neighbor. The utility needs to sell that kilowatt hour. So even if you have excess that you want to trade, it goes across the network, it goes across the wires, unless it's a complete private wire system. You are really impinging on the regulatory framework, and you can't be doing that. There's reasons for that, security and reliability and other things. We don't want outages. We don't want that to happen. We don't want someone to charge way too much right. for a kilowatt hour to their neighbor and have to deal with that. There's reasons that we try and keep costs down for consumers. So I don't think you need blockchain necessarily to do peer-to-peer unless you want to try and have those trades happen without the regulated utility, because we think actually it would be much more cost effective to do some kinds of electricity sharing or trading without that central utility. So I think that you've seen a few of these start in Australia and in the US. And so the peer-to-peer using blockchain, in theory, the benefits are, oh, no utility required. In practice, that will be, we're sort of using these projects to demonstrate the potential for that. And I think just selling production and consumption probably isn't the most advanced use of it, but it's a start. And then you could get into some of the other things you were talking about around demand side response, that there would be microtransactions also happening on other devices within that, say, microgrid community that would have real value in terms of grid services to the distribution network. So I think we don't need blockchain to do peer-to-peer, but if we start to take that to the next level, what happens after you share just your excess? What happens if you as a community can then bring in more solar or more storage so that you can actually be more self-sufficient as a community? Then you can start to imagine, well, if we did all have to plug in an electric vehicle, would we be able to manage that really huge additional load within our community instead of having to go back to the grid? So it's just about stacking that. And I think we do think the blockchain will be really exciting in terms of overcoming some of these barriers to sort of revenue stacking for things like storage and other things that enable demand side response. But ultimately, you know, we're at that very early stage. And so, yes, I think it would be easy to say, you don't need blockchain for that. But if we start to use it, we may start to see that the applications increase.
That's interesting. You know, I'd never really thought of it as sort of a management tool like that or a grid balancing method. You know, it always made sense to me.
In and of itself.
Yeah, but it could be used in that context, you're saying.
Yeah.
I always thought of it as more of a payment system.
Yeah.
But perhaps it's more than that. Yeah.
And it isn't just that. You're right. You know, almost every company I talk to who's operating in that grid edge space and trying to, you know, deploy a better meter or get a different kind of customer behavior, they're looking for better data, not just about production and consumption, but about what's really going on in the interactions at the grid edge. And I think that is a huge benefit in the first instance, because without some of that data, then the amount of business models and transactions that you can imagine are fewer. So we do have an ability to kind of unlock the data with blockchain that I think is fairly new.
Interesting. You know, the U.S. Department of Energy is now investing millions of dollars to develop blockchain technology as a way of securing distributed energy resources on the grid edge, as you mentioned a minute ago, which I always kind of interpreted to mean basically individual devices, which are often behind the meter, you know, is kind of at the very end of the chain.
Yeah.
And previously on this show, we've discussed the possibility of a future grid in which every device and every customer would effectively be part of a massive transactive market, negotiating power consumption and providing services on a real-time basis with a utility, I suppose, or maybe even just with each other, as you're talking about now.
Yeah.
But that really isn't practical from a security standpoint with today's technology. And as you say, as we have just an explosion in the number of devices that are participating in it, becomes more and more of a just a management problem to handle all those communications and transactions. Mm-hmm. So is that the real advantage of the blockchain in a massive real-time market, is the security aspect and the sort of maybe a more efficient kind of communications?
Yes, I think that's a huge benefit. And that vision that you're describing is really where we want to get to, because we think it solves more of the problems, or it helps us with decarbonization and other challenges, not because we just think a market is good in and of itself. We just have seen that being able to have a competitive marketplace to finance infrastructure or be able to improve services for customers, that potential is very exciting, particularly at a time when we want to accelerate adoption of some of these new grid edge solutions. So I think the typical way of securing I've heard someone describe, you know, securing a large amount of data, and this could be data around a physical infrastructure as well, as sort of perimeter defenses, perimeter security, and that's firewalls and other things that you put around what you don't want to be attacked. And then by centralizing it in that way, it becomes a sort of a gold mine if someone can access it. You know, the incentives for a hacker to get in there and be able to access that precious data, those incentives just grow. So the idea of decentralizing this is actually very, very powerful because it removes the incentive. Because if you hack one of the nodes, there is a distributed ledger on each node, but you wouldn't be able to change that ledger or do anything unless all the other nodes agreed. So you really don't have the ability to hack the system in the same way. If you get access to a bit of it, you're not going to have the same sort of gold mine of, you know, a honeypot of data. You're just going to have a little bit of access to one bit of it.
Right.
And so being able to change the security to something that everyone is invested in, so you earn the rewards for protecting the system are greater than dismantling the system. That is essentially what is built into a system like Bitcoin and what's really exciting about blockchain. So I think that I've heard the statistic, but I don't have the reference that there were something like 200 cyber attacks on US facilities last year. So we should look for the actual stats on this. But as that increases, we definitely need to think about this because it is so critical to our economies that we have secure energy.
You know, I've actually been trying to find an expert to talk to me about cybersecurity on the grid, but it may not surprise you to learn that most of them are not at liberty to talk about what they know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of a problem.
That's the other thing. I think we don't actually know. I think a lot of us as consumers, we really have had the luxury of not having to think about a thing when we just flick the light switch. And with things like the hurricanes that we've just witnessed.
Right.
And I'm in San Francisco where there are fires. You know, these are not things in our control.
Right.
And I think as these more egregious examples, which we hope are not too common, you know, are in the media, we realize that we can't take this security for granted anymore, whether that's someone trying to attack or whether it's just the weather.
Yeah. And sometimes I wonder, you know, as we're getting into a more and more technically advanced grid, we're actually building a lot of communications and intelligence into these various devices that make up the grid. And that actually exposes them to a cyber attack in a way that dumb devices that didn't have any communications capability were not vulnerable to. So there's kind of a paradox in there. You know, cybersecurity on the grid is receiving increased attention lately for some of the reasons you mentioned. And also there's been some very high profile hacking incidents that people did hear about, like the one in 2016 that shut down around 60 substations in the Ukraine. We had a pretty famous one that attacked the PG&E grid a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And now researchers are looking at vulnerabilities in these other newer grid components like solar inverters that have these communications capabilities. You know, it's got an IP address. If you know how, you can actually reach it over the internet. Mm-hmm. Is the blockchain really the best way to address these things, or should we be looking at other types of security methods like firewalls or secure communications channels and, you know, just policies and procedures as ways to secure the grid?
Yeah, I mean, I am not a cybersecurity expert for the grid.
Yeah, fair enough.
Unfortunately.
Expect you to know everything.
Yeah. No, I think, as I said before, just the high level intent is that you move toward a decentralized secure system where you don't need these firewalls and you remove the incentive of that centralized pot of information or that central point where if you hit it, everything else falls down. And you can think about that from grid architecture perspective as well.
Sure.
So I think the potential of blockchain shouldn't be ignored and we should be pursuing that. In the meantime, blockchain is not there at scale. It's not behind everything we do. And so the vulnerabilities will be there that we obviously need to look at our existing solutions, firewalls and other things, as a interim step. So I don't think it's either or. We can't just immediately throw in a dose of blockchain and everything is fine and secure. So I think Yeah, we just have to acknowledge that as we start to make the grid smarter, which has huge benefits, we're also looking equally at the security.
Sure.
This is kind of built into blockchain. It does both at the same time. The downside that some people are working through is these public ledgers. That's what Bitcoin is. You know, these are public. And so in theory, you could find out who was consuming what if you really tried. So there is work going on in energy blockchain companies on how to make sure that you secure not just the grid or the communications from attack, but also how you make sure that that information remains at the standard of the privacy that we want to see around energy data.
Yeah. You know, I want to turn our attention now to cryptocurrencies, and in particular, the massive energy cost of mining currencies like Bitcoin. You know, we say mining, but really it's just a lot of computers crunching away on specialized algorithms and burning energy to create new Bitcoin. And I was really quite shocked to learn how much energy is involved here. According to a recent report by the International Energy Agency, the global Bitcoin industry now consumes about 20 terawatt hours per year, which is more than the energy consumption of Iceland and nearly equivalent to the energy consumption of Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
Put another way, the Bitcoin network already consumes about 37 times as much energy as Visa, which processed 82 billion transactions last year, while Bitcoin processed hardly at all, any at all. And so I'm scratching my head going, wait a minute. One analyst recently estimated the global Bitcoin mining would require as much energy in 2020 as the entire nation of Denmark currently consumes.
Mm-hmm.
And while I haven't seen any studies yet that try to net out what the energy cost of Bitcoin is relative to its purported ability to reduce transaction costs in energy markets, I have to wonder, is there really any value here at all? And, you know, whether we've really thought this through. Are we potentially investing a ton of energy into making a new way of doing transactions where the advantage of the new method is outweighed by the energy required to do it?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And I have a history working in the information and communications technologies industry and the direct impacts of that industry and the enabling beneficial outcomes by utilizing this technology you could achieve in other sectors. So what's interesting is that we've started to talk about the potential benefits first. And now this is the question about, but wait a minute, if we do apply this at scale to get all of these benefits, isn't there some sort of negative impact? So it's just very common to think about both sides of this story. And we have been doing that for 10 years or so. I worked on a report called Smart 2020 back in 2007, 2008, where we did extensive research with McKinsey, looking at the McKinsey mitigation cost curve and all the solutions that we should be deploying to get to our 2-degree outcome. And we looked at whether information and communications technologies could play an enabling role in, say, accelerating solar deployment or accelerating LED deployment and making buildings more efficient. So at that time, when we looked at the direct footprint of ICT, it was sort of 7 or 8 times smaller than the benefits that could accrue from deploying smart grid and smart buildings and smart logistics and transportation systems and all of those benefits. That was because we were doing a couple of things. We were moving from desktop computers to laptops. We were getting more efficient in how we ran data centers. So we were seeing both form factor change in the devices and machines that we were using to deliver the benefits. So from akin to going from mainframe computers to desktops, we were going from desktops to laptops and even laptops to mobile phones. So for the computing power that we used to have in a mainframe that was a huge energy consumer, we now have much vaster computing capability in these distributed small devices. So we were seeing that form factor change and also just efficiency in telecommunications networks. So there is a huge amount of innovation that goes into just keeping the electronics and IT and telecommunications industries getting more and more efficient. And now we have blockchain, which is kind of the next level of innovation in the internet. And the data centers that are being used to mine Bitcoin obviously have an energy impact. We're I think, like other evolutions and revolutions in information and communications technologies, we're going to see that the blockchain technology also evolves to be less computationally intensive. And we already are seeing that. You know, we could go in and talk in some detail about that, but the high level is that to secure the Bitcoin network, we use something called proof of work, which is the consensus algorithm for all the nodes. Now, that is very computationally intensive, and there is already innovation in doing that differently. So I am a believer that we will continue to solve those problems just because you wouldn't be able to utilize Bitcoin at the scale that the industry already wants to use it if it continues to be this energy intensive. For every unit of computing to get a Bitcoin, you're using a lot of energy. That's just not going to scale, and everyone knows that.
Yeah.
But that's not to say we shouldn't be thinking about that. The value of blockchain is also, I think, in allowing some more of this decentralized computing that is more efficient. And we're just going to see the evolution of computing along with the evolution of the different sectors like energy that are utilizing this computing. So I guess I think that we will very quickly see the pace of innovation and efficiency around blockchain applications happen. So I'm more optimistic that we would never see a sort of growth path that's sort of linear, where we will always see the efficiency kind of keeping pace with the computing.
You know, I have to confess a little personal beef, I guess, with this. And that is that in order to prevent it from being too easy to generate Bitcoin, these algorithms are designed to be hard and to get harder as time goes on to mine a new Bitcoin. But the whole point of all that computational activity is just to mine the Bitcoin. And it just seems like a ridiculous waste to me. Like, why can't we instead have all these computers, like, I don't know, trying to solve some of the unsolved problems in astrophysics and using their computing power for that, and then getting paid a Bitcoin every time they do a certain number of transactions or computations or something?
That would be great too.
It just seems like such a waste to have the algorithms difficult to do and require so much computing power just so that they'll be difficult. You know what I mean?
Well, let's think about the value of having something that everyone trusts as a medium of exchange and how much work goes into that. And right now we have central banks and we have endless meetings and a whole range of activities that go into making sure that we can secure currency and that it continues to be a useful thing for society. So we're putting quite a lot of computation energy into trying to figure out a different way to do that, that we think has massive benefits. Now, that's our job. When I think about what I do, I want to make sure that those benefits are realized. I don't want to see all of the computational inputs of this go to waste. It isn't the same as solving major problems in physics or other things, but actually we're solving some social problems. We have to have these trusted ways of exchanging value, and we need to evolve that if we want the benefits we've talked about to also accrue. So it's easy to say Bitcoin is just a Bitcoin, but what that allows is very potentially a huge benefit and avoids other waste and costs that we currently just think are part of the system and we don't even question. So I guess that's just casting ahead and having a bit of a mindset change around what it is that this value is. Now, the other thing I'll say on this is Bitcoin is that hard to secure because it's totally open. So that has amazing value for the purists who want anyone in the world to be able to get access to a Bitcoin if they want to. But it also is highly computationally intensive. So there are other ways, I'll use a really basic analogy. There are other ways of getting access to coins, to tokens in these computational systems. So the basic analogy I've been thinking about is kind of thinking of a token as a ticket. And let's say I want to go to a fun fair with the kids, we have to buy tickets, right, to get on the rides. There is a park I went to in London where you can't get into the park unless you have a child with you. You don't have permission to enter the park unless you have a child, and then you can buy the ticket and go on the ride. If The things that are being developed now around blockchain are the permissioning level, where it's much less computationally intensive. It's just, if you don't have a child, you don't get into this park. If you aren't this type of stakeholder, you do not get access to this blockchain system. That takes away a huge amount of the computation, but it has the other side, which is, it's not a completely open system that anyone in the world could access if they had the ability. It basically says, you could, in theory, say, if you're not a customer of this utility, you don't get access to this secure energy services environment, which some would say is, you know, we're rolling back some of the benefits of this full decentralization, but I think is probably a necessary part of the evolution of blockchain.
All right. I'm cautiously willing to take your point about, you know, the point of there being barriers to entry, you know, but at the same time, it still just seems like such a waste of computational power, just difficulty for its own sake, you know, like, why can't we just
for Bitcoin?
Why can't we use that?
Noah, all I'm saying is that permissioned layer means that you don't have to go through all that computational work. You just give someone the ticket.
Yeah, I get it.
So you avoid that part of it. So for Bitcoin, it will change. It'll evolve. But for these other systems, from the outset, we can set them up to be much more energy efficient.
Yeah. You know, there's, on a related note, Tam Hunt, who owns a renewable energy project development company, recently published a piece in GTM in which he speculated that using solar power to mine Bitcoin could be a good investment, even as an off-grid operation. And he calculates that solar plus Bitcoin operation would actually pay for itself in about 2 years, which sounds pretty good if you believe in the future of Bitcoin. But at the same time, since my main interest is in energy transition, I feel like that's not necessarily the best use of solar either. I mean, if investors want to put up money for off-grid solar, I'd like to see them putting it in places like sub-Saharan Africa or India and bringing reliable electricity to people who don't have it, rather than just, you know, coming up with a replacement for currencies that are actually working all right already. So what are your thoughts about using solar to mine Bitcoin and some of the sort of the long-term energy implications of this?
Well, I guess I think we should be using solar to power everything.
Well, okay. We're agreed on that.
Exactly. And I'm aligned with you. I want us to be finding ways to provide energy access to people who don't have it and provide secure, reliable, life-changing energy to all of us who use it to prosper and provide comfort to our families and all of the things we do with energy. I'm much less interested in the business model of mining Bitcoin. So I think it's, of course, we should move toward renewable power for everything, but that wouldn't be my first concern at this stage, though I think we should be doing both in parallel. We should be figuring out how to make all of our computing completely renewable, and there are companies that are making commitments to that. You know, companies like Facebook and Apple and others that have big data centers and they're committing to 100% renewables. And I'm not saying they're mining Bitcoin, I'm just saying data centers.
Right.
But then we should be doing everything we can to apply this to solving those problems of energy transition. So
all right.
I would agree with you there.
Are there any new applications of the blockchain energy that you're particularly excited about?
So to your point about the ability to unleash kind of a huge set of transactions at the grid edge, that's where I think we're going to see a whole range of new systems, token systems and blockchains that will unlock these opportunities. And we're working with one company, LO3 Energy, on a new project that I think will start to put some of those foundational pieces in place. And the project is called Exergy. So very much links a lot of what we've been talking about for the past hour, the potential to not just use energy, but to use the useful work part of energy and incentivize useful work, Exergy, instead of the waste, is very much at the heart of this project. So the idea would be that we're creating a token system that allows us to do the most efficient transactions. It allows for the computing also to be very efficient, and it will give rise to applications like being able to buy a local energy product, as LO3 has already demonstrated in Brooklyn, and the Brooklyn microgrid, but other energy products and services, like being able to buy green. You know where that electricity comes from because you have the verified data right from the network about where that unit of energy was generated. So I think this is one of the most exciting areas. I don't think Exergy will be the only application in this area, but I think the team really has some great potential and actually operating use cases that show that this potential for blockchain is real. And we'll be putting out more announcements about different projects that are using Exergy in the coming weeks.
How interesting. Listeners to episode 53 on electrifying heat will be aware of the concept of Exergy, not the company, as being something that sort of reflects the efficiency of useful work. But how does this new blockchain application really improve your Exergy, if I'm understanding this properly?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it takes a little bit of explaining.
I'll bet it does.
Which is why
I struggle just to explain Exergy, But
yeah. I mean, I think the simplest example is this local energy product. So I'm a fan of Skip Leitner's work since he was at ACEEE looking at energy productivity, and his paper on Exergy from 2015 is great. We can probably put that in the notes as well. But he calculated in the US economy that we sort of 86% of everything we do with energy is wasted. And that means from combustion to transmission, distribution, you know, transporting and converting that energy into something that we can use, is we should be constantly focused on Exergy, not on energy. We should be focused on, is our rate of being able to turn energy into useful work increasing? And that is the process that underpins our productive economies. So I think for Exergy is the outcome we want to see. And to build the token dynamics to achieve that is what we're working on right now. For instance, with the local energy product, the way it's achieved in the Brooklyn microgrid is that you know if that energy is from your neighbor or if it's from farther away, because the communications network that's been built over the grid infrastructure in Brooklyn in this microgrid is very much sort of aligned with that electricity grid architecture. So you actually know if something was farther away or closer, you know, the location of that generation is recorded in the blockchain. So in that case, you could, in theory, be buying your neighbor's electricity, and that would be buying more useful work than if you bought it from farther away. So there'll be other ways that we'll have to look at Exergy in the context of this system, but that's one of the, I think, most obvious.
Wow, that's pretty heady stuff.
I don't know if, you know, everyone's going to want to learn all about the physics of Exergy, but I think it's a good name.
No, it is a good name. You know, again, I sort of struggled to explain Exergy when we covered that in episode 53, and I've no doubt that it'll be back because it really is a very important concept. I guess I'm beginning to think maybe the better way to explain it is, you know, sort of using the right tool for the job and not having sort of wasted effort, which is a little different than energy efficiency, but it's hard to parse those two concepts out sometimes. And, you know, I think this whole thing of blockchain is really so abstract in many mm-hmm. ways. It's hard to get your head around how it works or what it would do. And then you combine that with a concept like Exergy, and it's like, oh, man.
I do think we have a little bit of work to get this down to the day-to-day. Yeah. Back to the analogy of being able to go into the fun fair and get a ticket, I think we're trying to build the system that lets you have the bracelet to get in to buy the ticket to get the product that you want. And so designing all of that so that we're able to allow people to buy Exergy instead of energy would be great. I don't think people will necessarily know they're buying Exergy. They'll just think, oh, I'm buying from my neighbor, or I'm buying something that makes sure that if there is a hurricane, I have, you know, more likelihood that my system won't go down or I won't have access to energy during that time. So they probably won't know that it's Exergy, but that will be the outcome that we're trying to achieve on a layer below.
Right. It'll be something for the geeks to talk about and the rest of us to just sort of enjoy. Yeah. Okay.
There's something for everyone. Something for the geeks. Something
right,
for the wonks.
That's right. Well, this has really been a fascinating conversation. I do feel like I sort of understand blockchain and energy a little better. So
good.
Thanks for taking the time to share what you know.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great time to be in this space and a great time to be thinking about how many tools we can bring to bear on the energy transition.
It certainly is. Okay, thanks.
Pleasure to be here.
That was Molly Webb, the founder of Energy Unlocked. Even after spending an hour talking with her in this interview, I still feel like we barely scratched the surface of how the blockchain might play a role in energy transition. It's a complex and rapidly emerging technology and industry, and I suppose it just takes more than an hour to really explain it and start to explore some of the interesting issues in it. But hopefully we have at least succeeded in giving our listeners a useful first look into the subject, and with that out of the way, perhaps we can dive a little deeper into it in a future episode. Personally, I'm very much of two minds about the blockchain and energy. On the one hand, I definitely see the opportunity for it to enable and accelerate new types of transactions that might otherwise be difficult to stand up, such as using it in transactions involving electric vehicle charging, or demand response transactions between utilities and individual behind-the-meter devices, perhaps even without the intervention or participation of an aggregator company. On the other hand, it's not obvious to me if the benefit of having these new platforms will be greater than the effort and cost involved in building them, or if they'll actually turn out to be better than the conventional ways of doing things in the end. And I am truly horrified by the energy consumption of mining cryptocurrencies, so I'm glad to know that Molly also sees that aspect as being unsustainable and in need of reform. That has got to go. Surely there is another way to protect the integrity and security of these new cryptocurrency systems without burning vast amounts of energy rather pointlessly in the process. I suppose we'll have to just wait a few years and see how all this evolves. Perhaps new distributed energy trading platforms will prove to be so effective in stimulating the developments of markets for things like rooftop solar and smart home devices that my skepticism today will look silly and unimaginative. Or perhaps implementing these new technologies will prove to be difficult enough that they really didn't warrant all the hype that they're generating today. Or maybe it will turn out that the real applications that emerge for the blockchain and energy aren't even things that we're thinking about today. Such is the nature of a new, potentially disruptive technology. You don't really know where it's going to go. In any case, I feel confident that we will be returning to this topic again, hopefully when there is more real-world experience to analyze and talk about. Do you have a burning question that you'd like to have answered about energy transition? Well, here's your chance. Eric Gimone, who you'll remember from episode 20, has generously offered to host a Q&A for questions submitted by subscribers. So if you'd like a top-notch expert on energy transition to answer your question, email it to me at chris@energytransitionshow.com. Once we have 10 or so questions submitted, I will design an episode around them and have Eric back on the show to answer them. So send in your questions. And now a quick look at some recent news items. Item 1. Regular listeners will not be surprised to hear that more than twice as much solar generation capacity has been added in India during this fiscal year as coal capacity, at 2,500 megawatts versus coal's 1,300 megawatts. And while it's true that solar plants typically have lower capacity factors than coal plants, because coal plants can run around the clock, while solar plants without storage features can only run while the sun is shining, it's also true that, as we reported in the news segment of episode 51, the capacity factors of India's thermal power plants have been falling steadily, from around 80% 8 years ago to around 55% today. Experts I consulted blame the decline in part on the rapid addition of renewables because operating a solar plant will always be cheaper than operating a coal plant, so solar is gradually pushing coal off the grid. The continued growth of solar should continue to depress the operation of existing coal plants in India and decrease the likelihood that India will build a lot of new coal plants in the future, contra the typical forecasts for India to continue powering its growth with coal. Listen to episode 11 for further details on India's coal sector. Item 2. Lazard, the financial advisory and asset management firm, published its annual levelized cost of energy analysis for 2017 in early November. The report is widely watched among energy analysts because it offers a comprehensive and generally trusted set of data for comparing the costs of various electricity generators on a fair basis. It attempts to calculate the power price that a power purchase agreement would need to have to build and operate a new plant with a 12% internal rate of return. This year's report generated headlines as never before because it showed that building new solar and wind farms in the U.S. can be cheaper than the operational costs alone of old coal and nuclear plants. In other words, new renewable plants on a fully loaded, unsubsidized basis are now beating existing coal and nuclear plants in the same regions, raising the specter of accelerated retirements of the latter. Unsubsidized utility-scale solar prices in the new Lazard data run from $43 to $53 per megawatt hour. However, item 3. Chile's energy ministry says the lowest bid in its 2017 power auction was $21.48 per megawatt hour. The second lowest bid was $24.80. The power auction was for 2,200 gigawatt hours of capacity, but the auction attracted nearly 10 times that amount in bids, indicating that these are not anomalous bids, but rather the result of a vigorous industry. Meanwhile, the largest solar project in the world, a 1.2 gigawatt project in Abu Dhabi, reports that it is on schedule for an April 2019 commissioning. That project came in at $24.20 per megawatt hour. And the current world record for the cheapest solar power project is just $17.90 per megawatt hour for a project in Saudi Arabia to be built by Electricité de France SA and Abu Dhabi's Masdar. So just to highlight these results, the current low bids in Chile, UAE, and Saudi Arabia for utility-scale solar are roughly half the lowest prices shown for utility-scale solar in the Lazard data. But the Lazard data doesn't give you a clue that this could be the case, and most energy journalists who just write up the executive summaries of reports without trying to add any context won't flag that fact either. In reality, solar and wind are beating the bloody pants off of coal and nuclear, and they will continue to do so no matter what Trump says or does. As for why the levelized cost of energy data is so far off from reality, well, we might have to do a whole episode on that in the future. Any volunteers? And finally, item 4. Rocky Mountain Institute, my employer, is now publishing its own podcast, featuring various experts from the Institute talking about the ways that RMI is working to advance solutions to climate change and transform energy markets. So, if you're looking for a new energy podcast beyond this one, see the link in the show notes and check it out. In closing, thanks to all of you for supporting the show. Since we are entirely subscriber-supported, it could not exist without you. Be sure to take advantage of the interview transcripts, which are typically uploaded a week or two after each episode, and our extensive show notes, which are a great resource for further explorations into the topics we covered on the show. And if you're a student who wants to subscribe, or an educator who would like to use the show as coursework, as several university classes already do in the US, Canada, Australia, and Europe, we have an unbeatable educational discount available. Just drop us an email and we'll sort something out for you. And finally, thanks to all of you who write to share your feedback on the show and your suggestions for future shows. I love getting your emails, so please keep them coming. To reach me with show feedback or ideas, or to inquire about our educational discount, just use the comment form on any show page or email me directly at chris@energytransitionshow.com. And finally, help us find new listeners by telling your friends and colleagues about the show and leaving us a review on iTunes. We depend heavily on word of mouth to build our subscribership, so thank you for spreading the word. Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com and follow us on Twitter @transitionshow. Our theme music was by Mike Sugar and Mark Burnfield, who you can find online at mikesugarmusic.com. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XE Network.